To answer is human. To question is divine. Welcome to the world of the Hidden Gateway, an exhilarating podcast exploring the concepts humans have been struggling with since the dawn of existence, such as, who are we? Is there such a thing as good and evil, or are they arbitrary constructs? Does the paranormal exist? How can we evolve to a higher state? Can our mind influence what we term as reality? Providing a transcendental approach combined with hard-nosed humanistic analysis, we invite you on a journey to question your worldview in this theater of life. Join our host, Justin Williams, as he explores the outer realms of faith, the supernatural, human potential, and even our concepts of the universal creator with a fascinating array of guests. This is the unseen world, magical, mysterious, and mystical, where your only limitation is your imagination. This is the Hidden Gateway.
All right, everybody, welcome back to yet another episode of the Hidden Gateway podcast. As always, I am your host, Justin Williams. Today's guest is an award-winning true crime author who studied history and philosophy with Sir Roger Scruton at Boston University. He then went to Vienna, Austria on a graduate school scholarship and ended up living in the city for over a decade, working as a freelance writer and translator. His first book, Entering Hades, The Double Life of a Serial Killer, was a New York Times Sunday Book Review, Editor's Choice, a Men's Vogue Best Book of 2007, and the inspiration of the Infernal Comedy starring John Malkovich. Today, we are going to discuss his latest book, The Meaning of Malice, on the Trail of the Black Widow of Highland Park. Mr. John Leake, welcome to the Hidden Gateway podcast. How you doing?
I'm well. Thanks for having me, Justin.
All right. Very good. And you know what, John? Thank you so much for being here today. I have really been looking forward to this conversation. I've done my research on you, and you are a phenomenal author, and I can't wait to really dig into your latest book here. But first, please share with my audience a little bit of your background. So obviously, you studied with Sir Roger Scruton at Boston University, and you grew up in Texas. Is that correct?
I did. I was born and raised in Dallas, Texas. Where I live now, I was a wandering spirit. I spent about 20 years wandering around. I lived in Europe. Ended up living in Europe for well over a decade. I need to update my bio on that. But at the beginning of 2020, I moved back to my native Dallas, and I returned to a true crime story that had haunted me since my teenage years in Dallas in the 80s. So I was born in 1970, and the main action for me at the time growing up was in 83 and 84. There was a lady who lived down the street from me, and it's an independent township in the middle of Dallas County. It's called Highland Park. And it's an independent township. We have our own independent school district and police force. And I had the good fortune to grow up in an affluent place. And just down the street from me was a lady named Sandra Bridewell. And I would occasionally visit her house because I was friends with her daughter, Catherine, who was exactly my age and was my classmate. And even at the time, in the years 83, 84, when I would go to visit the Bridewell house, I sensed even at the time there was something unusual about Sandra. I mean, wow. You know how it is when you're 13 and 14 and you're just awakening to thinking of girls and women and a sort of that new kind of way in which you're thinking of them differently than you did when you were a child. And so right. I was awakened to this woman. She had this beautiful kind of snow white skin, this dark brown hair, these big dark brown eyes. And she would hold you with this gaze, with these big brown eyes. She'd kind of, whatever I said, even as a teenage boy, she seemed to find it very interesting. It was though I was saying the most fascinating thing she'd ever heard. So this made her different from other moms who really truth be told, weren't particularly interested in some teenage boy hanging out, or, you know, with their around the house talking about his BMX bike or whatever. But she had this kind of engaging way about her. So she stuck in my mind. So this is 83, 84. Fast forward just a few years, I noticed that my friend Catherine, so Sandra's daughter, that Catherine's family had abruptly moved from Dallas, and I heard from a mutual friend, to the Bay Area, to San Francisco. Mm. And in the year 1987, our local glossy magazine, D Magazine, suddenly publishes this cover story.
Death and Gossip. Okay.
Death and Gossip in Highland Park.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I'd never heard any of this before. When I would bump into Sandra, I had no idea that even at that time, she was very notorious. She was under suspicion at that time for being involved in the gunshot death of two people, her first husband. Her second husband then came down with cancer, with lymphoma, and Sandra, it would seem, took a fancy to her second husband's treating doctor, who's a sort of star oncologist in Dallas, kind of the go-to oncologist.
Okay.
Sandra took a fancy to the doctor as her second husband was dying of lymphoma. 2 months after her second husband died of lymphoma, the doctor's wife was found shot to death in her car at Dallas Love Field Airport shortly after she gave Sandra a ride to the airport.
Interesting.
Okay. Huh. So in both the first husband and the doctor's wife, the cops go to the scene. And both scenes kind of look like suicides. I mean, sort of superficially, they look like suicides.
Yeah, yeah.
So the Dallas County Medical Examiner in 75 with the first husband's death, and then in 82 with the death of the doctor's wife, he rules these suicides, okay? Okay. But then 2 years later, a young guy from Oklahoma who's just arrived in Dallas the day before, is driving down our street. Remember, I lived on the same street. And he sees standing in the front yard of one of these houses, this beautiful, snow-white-skinned, raven-haired lady. And he pulls over and parks his car, and he just feels drawn to this lady.
Huh.
So he goes up and he talks to her, and she sort of seems pleased to meet him. Remember what I was saying about how she'd hold your gaze?
Those mesmerizing eyes.
Yeah, yeah. There you go. So she lures him in. She tells him pretty quickly that she's pregnant. She's got a child on the way. Hmm. Unbeknownst to him, she's actually had a hysterectomy a few years earlier. It was impossible for her to be pregnant, but he doesn't know that.
Right.
Now, that's one of many things he doesn't know. Okay. So he marries this lady. 1 year later, on the eve of his one-year wedding anniversary, he's found shot to death in his car.
Oh, my goodness.
He was last seen leaving his friend's house to drive to an appointment to meet her, Sandra, who at this point he was estranged from. They were just 1 year into the marriage, but they weren't living together. He leaves his buddy's house to go meet with Sandra and is never seen again. Later turns up shot in his own car. This time, there's no confusing this with suicide. This is a homicide.
Right.
And Sandra quickly falls under suspicion. She remains to this day the prime suspect, but she was never arrested for this murder. Okay?
Hmm.
So then fast forward 20 years later, she finally is arrested in North Carolina, but not for murder. She's arrested for defrauding an old lady. Sandra pretended to be a Christian minister and missionary. She said that she was in between missions to Africa to take care of poor African children. And while she was waiting to go on her next mission, she offered to move in with this elderly widow to help out with chores around the house, go grocery shopping, cooking, and so forth. Stole the identity of this elderly lady, took out credit cards in her name, tried to reroute her Social Security benefit, plundered her finances. Sandra got busted for that. And she did 2 years in a federal pen. That's when I re-engaged in my research on this case.
Okay, that's when you did.
So
okay.
I've been following this since I was 17 years old when this came out. Mm-hmm. And then I've been researching it kind of off and on since 2007 when Sandra was arrested in North Carolina.
Wow. So she went to prison, federal prison, for 2 years for the North Carolina crime.
Correct.
Okay. And was never prosecuted for the murders of her husbands.
No. And I go into this in the book. I mean, the thing that is recurring in the book is that for some reason, law enforcement just can't seem to get it together and pull these cases together. What I conclude is that the biggest mistake that law enforcement made was they looked at the murder of the third husband in isolation. Okay, the medical examiner ruled it homicide, so they took their cue from the medical examiner and they focused all of their investigation on the third husband.
Okay,
and they concluded the evidence was too circumstantial. What I did, I went back and examined the apparent suicide of husband one,
right,
and then the apparent suicide of the doctor's wife. I was able to obtain the original Dallas Police Department photos of the death scenes, husband one, and then the doctor's wife. And I had those photographs examined by contemporary forensic experts. Remember, forensic science developed a lot between the 70s and early 80s and today.
Right.
So I had contemporary, very experienced, but up to date in their training and in their professional experience. I had these experts analyze the original photos of husband one and the doctor's wife, number two. And what we discovered is in those photographs are displayed multiple clear indications that these weren't suicides, these were homicides. So right. In my analysis in my book, The Meaning of Malice, I examine, that's Sandra, by the way, on her third wedding. That's her third wedding. Husband, wow. Whose shoulder she's sort of leaning on.
Okay.
My analysis is to view these three gunshot deaths together as part of the same series and to re-examine those first two that were erroneously ruled suicides. So in my opinion, and in the opinion of my forensic experts, the totality of this, particularly the physical evidence displayed in these crime scenes of husband one and the doctor's wife, reveal that this is a case of serial murder.
Yes, yes.
And Sandra was the last known contact of all three.
Okay, okay, very good. Now, you have a phenomenal documentary. It's about 45 minutes long on YouTube. You did a phenomenal, just a great job in that. And as I was watching that, I noticed that you said that there was no investigation in the death of her husband, the one that was ruled by suicide, which was her husband number one, if I'm not mistaken, correct?
Correct.
Okay. So now how did that play out? Now, so he had the gun in his left hand, and then it was something about he initially, allegedly, tried to slice his arm above the wrist, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, so he's a dentist. He has one year. I talked with some of his old dental colleagues who also went to the Baylor School of Dentistry in Dallas. They had a year of medical training and, excuse me, of anatomy training. So you're looking at the left arm here, where the radial artery comes up to the surface is where you, it's here where you take the pulse, right? The artery runs very deep along the bones to protect it. It comes up close to the wrist here. Now, when I got these photos, and I display this or I show this in the documentary, there are these incisions on his forearm that are going on this axis across the forearm. And he would have known, I mean, one of the first things that came to my mind is, he would have known that these incisions, these cuts to his forearm, would have no lethal effect.
Right.
Okay. It would be painful. It would be distressing, but it wouldn't kill him. So already there was something weird about that. And then, so there's a razor with no blood on it lying on the sheet with also no blood on it next to the razor.
Oh, wow.
His left fingers, so he's lying on his right side. His left fingers, which he purportedly has used to hold the razor blade, they have no blood on them. He's also got a gunshot wound to his head, and his left outstretched hand is lying on top of a .22 caliber target pistol. If you look closely at this, which I did with the help of a couple of forensic experts, just none of this makes sense.
Right.
We also know the medical examiner did rule that So the gunshot is on the left side of his head. Medical examiners, forensic people for a long time have been able to do this. They can tell from the powder pattern, the burning powder. And it's called tattooing. It's like the burning powder actually impregnates the skin. They can tell from the size of that pattern approximately how far the weapon was held away.
Okay.
And in this case, the medical examiner observed there was no muzzle contact. The weapon was actually held not far, but it wasn't touching his head. It was, you know, close, but not touching. That's very, very statistically unusual for
someone that commits suicide is going to have that muzzle on the temple.
You just put it there, and it's more comfortable. Yeah, you're not kind of trying to hold it like this, but you also know where it's aiming. I mean, you don't want to just blow your eyes out or something if you're really serious about this business.
Right.
You put it on your temple because now you know where it's going to fire. So there are published statistical analyses of single gunshot suicides, and really, I mean, almost none of them are not contact. That is to say, all of them are contact wounds. So that was just another piece of this puzzle that, at the time in 1975. It was not carefully examined. Now, the thing that's most notable, the single most notable thing about the crime scene as it's displayed in these photos, is he's lying in bed with his outstretched hand on this pistol, and the cover is drawn up. So if I'm lying and I shoot myself in the head, and my hand falls on the surface of the bed, you know, with the pistol, and then I retract my hand and I lie my hand on the pistol.
Right.
How did I just pull the cover up after shooting myself?
Right.
In the backside, so he's lying in kind of on his side in sort of a semi-fetal position on his side. The backside of the comforter is tucked along the backside of his butt and his legs. So he got into bed to kill himself and then reached over and tucked himself in.
Oh, no.
Now, I talked to a retired FBI profiler about that. And he said he's seen it many, many times. It's very characteristic of someone that's been shot by someone in their intimate circle.
Mm.
This seems to be expressive of psychology in which, you know, there's something, I don't care how cold you are, when you shoot someone and you take a human life, there seems to, even in the most cold-hearted, there seems to be this instinct. It must be quite a terrible moment to see someone die after you pulled the trigger. There is this instinct to tuck in.
Wow.
And I was actually talking to a friend of mine who was briefly involved in the mafia. And he told me he knew of an instance in which a mafia hitman went to a drug dealer's house to shoot, to do a hit on the drug dealer. Okay. Mm-hmm. He does the hit. He shoots the drug dealer in his bed. The hitman actually gets into the bedroom, shoots the drug dealer in bed. And the hitman did the same thing. The
same thing. Wow.
He tucked the guy in.
Wow.
But this was a more recent case. The cops actually knew to look for this.
Okay.
They actually got a knuckle print of the guy on the inside where he tucked the comforter.
Wow. Okay.
So I didn't know about this until I talked to this former FBI forensic psychologist who said, I've seen this before. This is not unusual.
Wow. Very interesting. Now, Sandra, she's still alive, right?
I believe she's still alive.
Mm-hmm.
And people have told me, you know, I hope you sleep with one eye open.
I don't think you have anything to worry about. But goodness,
she might watch this. Anyway, if she does, hello, Sandra. It's not personal.
Strictly business.
I'm just a man who gathers facts.
There you go. Now, do you think there could possibly be people out there with information who haven't come forward?
I think so. I gave a reading the other night here in Dallas, and one of Sandra's old friends was there, and she approached me afterwards. I had never interviewed her before. I'd seen her name noted in some diaries and so forth, but I'd never been able to track her down.
Okay.
So, but she came to my reading, and I had dinner with her afterwards. Wow. She didn't tell me anything of an evidentiary nature, but she filled in some gaps.
Did she?
And I am receiving calls from people in the community.
Good.
What I'm encouraging people in my community to do, because I'm pretty confident that particularly in the case of the second victim, the doctor's wife, I'm quite confident there are individuals in the community that know about this, that have more information about this. And for reasons that I present in the book, they have been reluctant to come forward in this particular case.
Okay, so there's a slight chance justice may be served, huh? Slight chance.
Well, I mean, I wrote the assistant district attorney of Dallas County yesterday, and I electronically, and I included a link to my documentary, and I said, you know, I think if you look at the evidence presented, you will recognize that husband one and the doctor's wife were not suicides. So first of all, the medical examiner's suicide ruling needs to be changed to homicide, and they need to reopen these cases.
Very good.
I mean,
I
think that's clear.
Yes.
So we'll see if they do it. You know, law enforcement is a funny thing these days. You never know what they're interested in looking at.
Oh, well said, my friend. Well said. Wow, John, this has been great, man. Please let the audience know where they can purchase the book. And, you know, you have a website. Give all your website. If you have any social media, please provide that information, too.
Thank you very much. So your viewers can find me at Author John Leak, and my name is JohnLeake, authorjohnleake.com. And there you can see information about this book and my other books. This is my fourth book. You can also find my documentaries on YouTube. I have a YouTube channel, Author John Leak. I believe you've interviewed my partner with whom I write about other things. Dr. Peter McCullough and I write a Substack together. That's Courageous Discourse with Dr. Peter McCullough and John Leake.
Very good. Yeah, Dr. McCullough has been on the show twice, two times. Both great episodes as this. And I want to thank you so much for coming on. Now, I do have one final question for you, John. And this is something I ask each and every guest that appears on the Hidden Gateway podcast, you know, and that is to leave our audience with what I like to call a token of love, simply something that you feel that they can take with them as they move forward in their journeys. Anything can be anything, anything that comes to heart. What would you like the audience to know?
I would like the audience to know that if you're struggling with an inner conflict, something's weighing on your conscience, as I so often saw in researching this book, the truth will set you free. If you've done something, you may have to take some licks and suffer some disciplinary action as a result of it, but you'll feel much better and you will be forgiven. Truth and justice results in love and forgiveness.
I love that. And I know there's somebody out there listening that absolutely need to hear that. Mr. John Leake, thanks again for being on the Hidden Gateway podcast. And to the audience, I really hope you enjoyed this episode as much as I did. Check out the website, buy his book. You won't be disappointed. Great true crime author here. And as always, stay connected with us at thehiddengateway.com. And thank you for pushing your mindset towards a better reality. This will conclude this week's episode. Until next time, stay positive, stay questioning, be love, and be free. The Hidden Gateway, out.